back, everybody, to the second part of this month's episode of Ankle Surgery Update, Science Guiding Treatment. This time, we pick two papers dealing with the hindfoot arthrodesis. The first paper investigated the effectiveness of closed arthrodesis in infected neuropathic ankle using Elizarov ring fixation. The second paper had a look at the long-term pain impairment following autologous bone grafting from various regions.
In the first paper, we had a look at what was published in the Bone and Joint Journal by Alamar et al. The study is entitled Closed Arthrodesis in Infected Neuropathic Ankles Using Elizarov Ring Fixation. Infected and deformed neuropathic feet and ankles are a serious challenge for surgical management. Furthermore, patients with these conditions must be considered a high-risk population. Ankle arthrodesis is often the only way to treat the deformity. For open ankle arthrodesis, high complications rates have been reported. Consequently, minimal invasive techniques should be considered. In this study, the authors took the minimal invasive technique a step further and evaluated their experience of performing ankle arthrodesis in a closed manner without surgical preparation of the joint surfaces by cartilaginous debridement. Instead, they simply applied an Elizarov ring fixator to correct the deformity in arthritic neuropathic ankles with associated osteomyelitis. Retrospectively, all patients who underwent closed ankle arthrodesis in the Elizarov Scientific Center from 2013 to 2018 were reviewed and compared with a similar group of patients who underwent open ankle arthrodesis. All patients included suffered from osteomyelitis and had neuropathy such as Charcot joint or Charcot-Marie tooth disease. In the closed group, arthrodesis were performed without joint preparation by simply applying an Elizarov ring fixator. In the open group, an open debridement of the cartilage was performed, and thereafter the ring fixator was applied. If any soft tissue treatment was needed, it compromised of a percutaneous release of the Achilles tendon only. All patients were followed up clinically and radiographically for a minimum of 12 months to assess bony union and function. In the closed group, 21 patients were included with a union rate of 81%. The four patients suffering in non-union all showed a recurrence of the infection and underwent revision with an open technique and then achieved union. In the open group, 39 patients were included, demonstrating a union rate of 85%. Again, the reason for non-union in these six patients was a recurrence of the infection and all healed after open revision surgery. The mean duration in the Elizarov ring fixator was 72 days in the closed group and 69 days in the open arthrodesis group. The American Orthopedic Foot and Ankle Society hindfoot score was comparable for both groups. According to the authors, in the open group, more wound complications were observed without stating any details. The mean operating time was 40 minutes in the closed compared to 80 minutes in the open group. The authors concluded that closed ankle arthrodesis using an Elizarov ring fixator is an effective method for ankle arthrodesis in infected neuropathic foot and ankle cases and afforded comparable results to the open methods. They are convinced that the Elizarov method should always be considered for neuropathic ankles in suitable patients.
Most definitely, the Elizarov Scientific Center is a highly specialized center with great expertise of complex cases and the use of ring fixators. The authors introduced various new concepts in this paper. First, to my knowledge at least, it is the first paper on a closed technique for arthrodesis without any joint preparation. From a traditional point of view, it is hard to imagine a joint to fuse just because it's being immobilized and compressed using an external fixator. Furthermore, if this concept really leads to bone fusion, how can be ensured that only the ankle joint is fused? Other joints, such as the subtalar and the joints of the hind and midfoot, did not fuse, although they were equally immobilized and compressed by the ring fixator. If this technique really leads to fusion of the ankle, it must result at least in a functional arthrodesis of the hind and midfoot. Second, It is noteworthy that only patients with an osteomyelitis were included, and apparently no operative treatment was performed regarding the infection prior to fusion, neither in the closed nor in the open group. Still, infection rates were 19 and 16% only. Unfortunately, nothing is reported regarding the use of antibiotics or any other treatment to address the osteomyelitis. Again, from a conventional point of view, most surgeons would perform various debridements prior to the arthrodesis. It is astonishing that, according to the authors, no specific treatment is necessary to fuse an infected joint. This most definitely is again a new concept, which will require more studies before being implemented in everyday clinical practice. Third, the author stated that correction of the deformity was achieved immediately during the first operation. Within some cases, additional percutaneous release of the Achilles tendon, but no other peritalar releases. This is even more astonishing when looking at the pictures of the severely deformed exemplary presented in the study. Other studies using external fixator required weeks to months of gradually correcting the deformity. Furthermore, most of the studies available report that a much more extensive soft tissue release is necessary in order to achieve a plantigrade foot. Last but not least, the mean time in fixators seems extremely short, with 72 days in the closed and 69 days in the open group. Afterwards, the patients were immobilized in a cast and progressed to full weight bearing over a short period of time. This is in contrast to many other studies reporting much longer time and frame. Besides that, from my point of view, the study suffers various minor limitations, but to go into more detail would be too much for now. Okay, Hans, so what did we learn for our daily practice?
Well, that, Sebastian, is really a good question. From my point of view, the lesson learned is that there might be situations in which fusion of the ankle could be possibly achieved without preparation of the joint. In super high-risk patients, we might try this one day.
The second study is entitled Long-Term Autograft Harvest Site Pain After Ankle and Hindfoot Arthrodesis by Baumhauer et al., published in Foot and Ankle International. Autologous bone grafting is one of the essential techniques to promote bone healing in cases of non-union or arthrodesis. It is believed to be superior to allogenic or synthetic grafts as it contains additional bone growth factors. Still, the major downside to autologous bone grafting are harvest site complications. The most commonly used regions for autologous bone harvesting are the iliac crest, and it is well known that about 20% of patients suffer harvest site related complications, with pain being the most frequent. In 2014, Judith Baumhauer investigated, amongst others, graft site complications after 1 year per different harvest sites in 130 patients. The sites investigated were, in descending order, the proximal tibia, distal tibia, calcaneus, and the iliac crest. After 1 year, 9% of patients had clinically significant pain at the bone harvest site, which did not differ significantly between the groups. The authors now published a follow-up study with the same patient population, but a minimum follow-up of 5 years. They reassessed harvest pain site, fusion site pain, and weight-bearing pain using a 100-point visual-log analog scale. 58 patients, which equals 45% of the original cohort, were available for the current follow-up at a mean of 9 years after initial surgery. The harvest sites, again in descending order, were the proximal tibia, iliac crest, calcaneus, and the distal tibia. Whereas around about 50% of the patients were available for a follow-up in the proximal tibia, iliac crest, and calcaneus group, only 17% of the distal tibia group were available for a follow-up. 37% of the patients reported some level of graft harvest site pain. The actual VAS scores are not stated clearly. Instead, the authors chose a cutoff of 20 points defining clinically significant pain. Based on this criterion, only 3 patients, which equals 5%, reported clinically significant graft harvest site pain. In 2 patients, the graft had been harvested at the proximal tibia, which equals 7% in the proximal tibia cohort. In 1 patient, the graft had been harvested at the iliac crest, which equals 10% in the iliac crest cohort. These patients also had higher pain levels at each previous follow-up. Finally, no correlation could be found between graft volume and pain. The authors concluded that patients should be informed that autologous bone graft harvesting can result in chronically and clinically significant pain.
Thanks for presenting this paper, Sebastian. Despite the considerable loss of follow-up, the follow-up period presented by Baumhauer and colleagues is impressive. Going through the paper, to me it remained a little unclear what the actual VAS point scores were. They might be presented in Figure 2, but at least the one-year follow-up data are hard to interpret. But more importantly, the paper does highlight the importance of one of our daily problems, bone graft harvesting. The site where to harvest the bone is predominantly determined by the volume of bone needed. If only small volumes are needed, it is convenient to harvest the bone within the actual surgical field. For example, when doing a mini open AMIC procedure on the anterior lateral talus, the distal tibia is easy to reach. In case larger volumes of trabecular bone are needed, the only 2 sites suitable for us are the iliac crest or the proximal tibia. Previous studies were able to demonstrate that the same amount of bone can be harvested from both these locations. There is a seemingly endless discussion on which of the 2 locations is favorable. On the one hand, previous studies have reported considerable complications when harvesting at the iliac crest. These include nerve injuries, fractures, and most importantly, long-lasting pain. On the other hand, multiple colleagues favor the iliac crest because of presumably favorable biological properties of the mesenchymal stromal cells contained therein. Still, this had never been proven. Therefore, we conducted a study comparing the proliferative and osteogenic differentiation capacity of the mesenchymal stromal cells isolated from grafts harvested at either the iliac crest or the proximal tibia. Based on almost 50 samples, we found comparable biological properties of the mesenchymal stromal cells for both of these harvesting sites. Based on these findings, we choose, whenever possible, the proximal tibia as bone graft harvesting site.
Thank you, Hans. I think this is one of the great parts of doing research, that we do see a clinical problem that everybody's talking about and not really anybody has had a look into. And the study you presented on the 50 samples looking at the biological properties of the 2 harvesting sites really is amazing. But let's come back to the study. I think the study by Baumhauer and colleagues does highlight 2 things. First, longitudinal data collection over decades is essential and definitely worth the effort. Second, we have to pay close attention to not only inform patients on complications and the expectations of the dominant part of the surgery, but also on possible effects of accompanying interventions, such as bone graft harvesting. Although only a minor aspect of the whole surgery, it by itself can result in a possible lifelong impairment. Thank you, everybody, for listening to this month's episode of Ankle Surgery Update. It again has been fun, and we are very much looking forward to your feedback. Stay tuned and make sure to turn in next time.